Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Voiko vanhemmuuteen valmistautua? Mikä vauvakuplassa on totta ja mikä ei? Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Qureshi, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 20th of April, these are our main stories.
He's on fire. Another area in the park where some of the accelerant spilt is also on fire. Civilians, court officers, members of the police department, they make efforts to put him out.
Dramatic scenes as a man sets himself ablaze outside the New York courthouse where Donald Trump is due to stand trial. Israel appears to have delivered its response to Iran's barrage of drones and missiles last weekend. But what might happen next? And
invented, did they say?
We were seeing around 20 deaths and around 15 hospitalizations per day. Around the country, it would exceed hundreds.
Malians struggling to survive in a scorching heat wave. Also in this podcast, why has President Xi unveiled a new cyber force in China? And the American football star who lost his Super Bowl ring in a pool of chili.
Somebody at some point messed with my Super Bowl ring, which I'm fine with. I mean, it's just a hunk of metal. I'll just have another one made, I think. They can do that, right?
Reality dawns on Jason Kelsey. There were frightening scenes near 100 Center Street Courthouse in New York, the venue where Donald Trump is going on trial. A man set himself ablaze in a park with a fire accelerant, throwing pamphlets in the air, which the police described as conspiracy-based. He's been named as Maxwell Azzarello. The FPNY, the New York Fire Patrol, responded quickly, as did the police. Jeffrey Madry, the chief of the city's police department, spoke to reporters about what happened to the man.
He's on fire. Another area in the park where some of the accelerant spilt is also on fire. Civilians, court officers, members of the police department, they make efforts to put him out. They use their coats, fire extinguishers. Eventually, FDNY, we're able to put the male, extinguish the fire. And from that point, we remove him to a Cornell burn unit where right now he's there in a critical condition.
But all jurors have now been chosen for Donald Trump's trial, the first criminal trial of a former or sitting US president. He denies falsifying accounts to hide a hush money payment to the porn star Stormy Daniels just before the 2016 presidential election. She said this was to keep her quiet about an affair she had with Mr. Trump, a claim he rejects. Our correspondent Neda Taufik was at the scene in New York when the man set himself on fire.
I can tell you that the park is just a few feet in front of where I am right now, directly across from this courthouse, and you can still see officers there, the investigation ongoing. But the press were here. We had just gotten word around 1:30 that jury selection was complete. When you could see and hear the commotion as that young man walked into the park, threw the pamphlets in the air and set himself on fire, many here screaming at that scene, calling out for a fire extinguisher, and it took about 2 minutes for police to get around into the park to him to try to put the fire out. He is in hospital now in critical condition, and what we heard from police in that update is that he is a male that was born in 1987 from St. Augustine, Florida. So he had recently arrived in New York. His car was last seen in Florida on the 13th, and his family didn't even know he was here. They're still unclear on his motive, but they do not believe that he was targeting any particular individual or group or indeed this trial. And they base that on what they say were conspiracy theory-like posts on social media before this incident and the nature of those pamphlets that he threw in the air. But nevertheless, they say that they are going to be reviewing security protocols. This is a park that is open to the public. They're going to decide if they need to shut the park down or if additional resources have to be pulled in. Donald Trump, everyone involved in the trial, has been made aware of this incident, but the court has resumed and it is on schedule.
Neda Taufik. Parts of the Middle East seemed calm in the hours after an apparent Israeli attack on Iran raised the spectre of spiralling violence between the two implacable enemies. If it was the Israelis, as almost everyone seems to assume, they calibrated their actions carefully, striking an area where Iran has a nuclear facility, as well as an airbase and other significant military sites. The Iranians were quick to talk down the impact and significance of the attack, but in Tehran on Friday, feelings were still running high, with crowds chanting anti-Israeli slogans. The muted response from Iran has raised hopes that regional tensions can be kept in check. The UN Secretary-General and US Secretary of State led the international calls for calm, followed later by the White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
We have been very, very clear from the beginning that we do not want to see this conflict escalate. We continue to consult with our allies and partners, including in the region, obviously, and to reduce further risk of escalation.
BBC's Wira Davis is in Jerusalem. I asked him if Friday's strike looked like a one-off or the start of something bigger.
I think it has drawn a line for now under this particular row between Israel and Iran. Most Israelis had expected their government to respond. But there was some surprise that it happened right now, because we're about to enter the Jewish Holy Week of Passover, and most Israelis assumed this would have happened after Passover. But again, it falls into the narrative of Benjamin Netanyahu that Israel would respond. You know, he rejected those calls from the US and the UK last Sunday in the immediate aftermath of the Iranian attack. So Israel, it felt it had to do something. This was its response for now. It's very, very limited. But Iran has got major allies in the region, particularly Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. Iran could quite easily continue its conflict against Israel through Hezbollah.
You are in Jerusalem. What's the reaction been there to this seeming Israeli attack on Iran?
Israeli public opinion is divided. They want to live in a peaceful society, in a peaceful region, but we keep on having these wars, and a lot of Israelis want to see an end to that. But equally, they see the impact of aggression against Israel. You know, Israel is a small country, and they say it has already shrunk. If you think of those communities now, those kibbutzes around southern Gaza, that people are not living for the time being, then in the northern border, there are 80,000 people who've been evacuated from the northern border because of the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah. And now with what is happening with Iran, Israelis were beginning to feel threatened again from the east. So there are Israelis who support their government's belligerent approach. There are also other Israelis who see the peril in that and want some sort of negotiated solution.
Wira Davis there in Jerusalem. So will Israel and Iran now heed the numerous pleas for a de-escalation and try to keep the peace? Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, gave me her assessment after a week of heightened tension.
Both sides will want to project the notion that they have re-established deterrence, but equally that they are in pole position for the next round, because there will be a next round. It had been widely predicted that Israel would strike after the Passover holiday. The fact that it decided to strike before indicates it believed it was absolutely critical to send a very strong signal to Iran that Israel would and could strike wherever and however it wanted to. The fact that it didn't even acknowledge it officially means that Iran has been able to exploit this grey space and say, well, it was so weak, we don't even know who did it. Both sides are, for the moment, claiming victory, but both sides know it isn't over.
An interesting take, maybe from the Iranians then, seeming to be talking down the likelihood of them taking any further action against Israel. Is that reassuring, or could there be another sting in the tail? You say this isn't over.
Bear in mind that in the days leading up to what happened in the early hours, a very limited strike. For days, Iran was saying, if you hit us in the tiniest of ways, you will face an immediate and harsh response. The fact that it's trying to project the idea there was no invasion, it may not even have been Israel, we just don't know, there was no damage, means that they save face. They don't have to reply. But they make it very clear that their so-called strategic patience doctrine is over. And if Israel, before or after the Passover holiday, strikes again, Iran will strike back.
Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette. Now, can you imagine ice as a luxury item? Well, in the West African country of Mali, ice has become just that. The cost has tripled in some parts of the capital, Bamako, due to a searing heat wave and severe electricity crisis. The increase in temperatures, reaching highs of 48 degrees Celsius, has resulted in more than 100 deaths. Priya Sippy has been speaking to people across Bamako to find out how they're coping.
In a quiet commune in Bamako, Mali's capital, 15-year-old Fatuma Yatara is on her way to buy ice from the local vendor.
I've come to buy ice here because it's very hot now. People need to drink fresh water at least. In some places, it's 100 francs, 300, 500, you know. It's too expensive.
People in Bamako are suffering from a heat wave that's reached 48 degrees. But for many, using ice to cool down is no longer an option. Assistant Traor lives in Magambuku in Bamako. She says the cost of ice has tripled in some places. It now costs more than bread and milk.
Sellers bring us ice from the military camp and sell it to us at 300 francs a unit. We hardly ever have electricity in Magambuku, so in the end, we have no choice.
Severe power cuts have left people unable to use their fridges, making ice more scarce and driving up prices. The constant power cuts are also making it difficult to store food. To find relief from the scorching temperatures, some try to splash their body with water, as is the case for Sumali Maiga, who lives in Bamako. He takes a small metal kettle and pours water over his head.
It's unbearable for me, given my health, because I suffer from dizziness. I pour water on myself all day long to survive. And we suffer. We really suffer.
More than 100 people have died from heat-related causes since the heatwave began in March. Professor Yakuba Toloba works at the University Hospital in Bamako.
We were seeing around 20 deaths and around 15 hospitalizations per day. Around the country, it would exceed hundreds. Most of these patients came in with dehydration. The main symptoms were cough and bronchial congestion.
Many countries in West Africa have been experiencing record-breaking heat waves, which scientists are attributing to climate change. Back in Bamako, local vendors continue to stock their fridges with water as temperatures look to remain over 40 degrees for the next few weeks. For Malians, this is their new normal for now.
Priya Sippy with that report. Mark Zuckerberg, the 39-year-old founder and CEO of Meta Platforms, is making headlines on multiple social media platforms, posing in a photoshopped image with a bearded look that has gone viral. Also causing a buzz is Aidan Ross, the famous streamer with millions of followers, is the latest celebrity to have his likeness faked using artificial intelligence by online scammers. Viral clips show an AI imposter pretending to be the star, encouraging unwitting fans to smash high-priced electronics for money. BBC reporter Laura Kress told James Reynolds more.
So I've seen these videos. Yeah. They're up on TikTok. It does look like him. And I think what they've used stream footage from him, and they've also used AI voice modulation. I have to say some of the clips don't really sound that much like him. He's got quite a high-pitched voice.
Okay.
And he gets very excitable. I think that's quite hard for AI to modulate. And this is using this video chat app called Monkey, where you talk to random people on random videos. The fans that he's talking to are quite young and quite impressionable. So a lot of the time, even they are questioning at the beginning when they're talking to this AI persona. They're saying, is that you? They're not sure. But the more they talk to him, the more, because he's quite known for doing these sort of prank videos. So this is the kind of thing he could potentially do.
And have people been taken in?
Yeah, so that's where these clips have gone viral, because this AI persona, he's saying things like, go on, smash your TV, smash your PlayStation, smash all these devices you've got, and I'll pay more than what it's worth. But he does do that kind of thing. He gets people to do stunts for money on some of his services.
And Has he responded at all? And how can he respond when he says, look, this is really me and I'll prove it?
There is a reaction video of him reacting to this, but I thought, wait a second, this could just be another AI reacting to that video.
It starts
to make your head hurt, but I think it actually is him. And what's interesting is he says, it doesn't sound like me. He actually does say, that's not funny. But then he does say at the end, he says, don't break your stuff unless it's actually me. It's telling that he doesn't mind the prank, but he maybe doesn't like that it's someone taking his likeness.
And Laura, while we got you, our day began on the group chat with a picture of Mark Zuckerberg with a beard.
Yes.
Why were we talking about that?
Yes, a lot of people were liking this picture. So yeah, the head of Meta, he had this launch of this new version, funnily enough, of Meta AI. And after sharing this video, someone photoshopped a screen grab of Mark Zuckerberg with a beard. It's a fake picture, completely photoshopped again, but quite a few people were taken in by it. And a lot of people actually thought maybe he should grow a beard after seeing the image.
Laura Kress there speaking to James Reynolds. The reach of Indian culture is global, and this summer one of the world's biggest live music events, Glastonbury here in England, will have its first ever dedicated South Asian area. Festival goers will find it in the Shangri-La section, which celebrates underrepresented art and culture. The announcement comes in the same week that saw the launch of the first ever official British Asian music chart to help more young talent into the big time. Bobby Friction is a DJ and presenter on the BBC's Asian Network, and he's been going to Glastonbury for more than 30 years. He told me what he thought of the changes.
I'm feeling on top of the world, actually, because I'm someone who loves Glastonbury. I've lived, breathed it over the years as a hunter and a performer. And this was a dream of mine. And I thought it might take 10 years, but it's actually taken about 10 months.
Why so significant?
A, there's stuff happening in Britain culturally where essentially the British Asian community is now 10% of the population. And in Britain, we're still very traditional with our entertainment and music. It's still very much we make music or we look towards our black brothers and sisters. But the idea of a multiplicity of different musical sources isn't something we're really good with in Britain. Globally, Latin music is one of the biggest music forms. So is Korean music and K-pop and Afrobeats. You know, some of the most streamed artists in the world are South Asian. So it's all of that timing globally and also the timing demographically here in Britain, which means that this year had to be the year it was going to happen.
What can festival goers expect to see then?
It is definitely a South Asian musical space. There'll be, of course, stuff like drum and bass and house music and electronic music and hip-hop and jazz, but a lot of it will have a South Asian influence. And actually, the stage design is based on a kind of concept of South Asian futurism. It's going to be like a Bollywood movie, but a science fiction one in the 25th century.
And what do you think the audiences will make of this?
Well, I think the audiences at Glastonbury are possibly some of the most open minds here in Britain. So I think they're going to really like it. And people who go to Glastonbury to see your established artists like Dua Lipa or Coldplay still want that thrill of the new, that real radical creativity. We're going to give them that, and we're giving it to them in Shangri-La, which traditionally has been the more radical side of Glastonbury anyway.
DJ and presenter Bobby Friction. Still to come on the Global News podcast, the cutting-edge technology being created to make gaming easier for disabled people.
I'm just moving around here in Minecraft by using my right arm as a mouse and my left arm like a joystick. That is so cool.
I was also able to play Minecraft using eye tracking.
The cow! Ah!
China's President Xi Jinping has appeared at a ceremony in Beijing to unveil a new cyber force. The aim, says Beijing, is to bolster China's capacity to fight and win wars. The move comes weeks after Western countries, including the US and Britain, accused the communist state of cyber espionage. So then, what is the purpose of this new force? A question for our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Celia Hatton.
There was a ceremony held in Beijing today. Xi Jinping, who crucially, he's also the head of China's Central Military Commission. He was at this special ceremony to present a flag designating the beginning of this Information Support Force, which is a new branch of the military. He gave a speech saying that this was a major strategic decision of far-reaching significance. So basically signaling that this branch is of incredible importance. He said crucially that it's important in winning modern wars. We know that the Information Support Force is directly situated under the Central Military Commission, so it's quite important in terms of ranking. What we don't know is how this new Information Support Force fits in line with the old branch of the military that used to deal with this kind of stuff. It was known as the Strategic Support Force, and it was established way back in 2015. And it was supposed to offer intelligence for all of the military, expand the military's capabilities in cyberspace and psychological warfare. But clearly Xi Jinping thought it was important enough that he should emphasize that this was a major decision.
What does this tell us about China's defense strategy? Is it moving more toward cyber warfare?
I mean, when Xi Jinping first came into power more than 10 years ago, one of the first things he said was to announce that China's People's Liberation Army, which at the time had the world's largest standing army, was outdated. He said it needed to be overhauled. And that's really what he's done. And he's really made it a modern army.
And tell us about the timing here. Just weeks ago, we might recall, the US was joined by other countries, Canada, Britain, New Zealand, in saying their governments, journalists and corporations have been targeted by Chinese cyber espionage.
Just yesterday, the U.S. National Security Agency warned again that they believe that China is trying to access critical infrastructure so that it can threaten that infrastructure in a conflict. So we've been having the United States and U.S. allies repeatedly accusing Beijing of carrying out espionage operations. So 3 weeks ago, they actually named the group that they believe is doing this in China, the APT-31, the Advanced Persistence Threat Group, is a group believed to be of state-backed Chinese hackers who are targeting governments, journalists, corporations around the world, not just in the United States, which is an obvious target, but in countries like Finland. Finland says that APT-31 attacked its parliament not too long ago.
Celia Hatton there. Belgian ambassador to the Democratic Republic of Congo says the country should file a complaint with the International Court of Justice over Rwanda's failure to respect its border. Speaking at a meeting to assess the deepening crisis in eastern Congo, Roxane De Bilderling said more should be done to hold Rwanda to account. Congolese forces have been struggling to push back M23 rebels. Our Africa regional editor Richard Hamilton has this.
The UN says fighting in eastern Congo has displaced more than 700,000 people in the first 3 months of the year. The conflict can be traced back to the Rwandan genocide in 1994. Several Western countries, including the former colonial power Belgium, accuse Rwanda of backing the M23, which Kigali denies. It in turn blames Kinshasa for arming a Hutu rebel group, the FDLR. The M23 are Tutsi-led, and many analysts say Rwanda is using them to protect itself from Hutus who were perpetrators of the genocide, but who fled across the border afterwards.
Richard Hamilton. The US has resumed sanctions against Venezuela's crucial oil industry for failing to meet a deadline this week to ease its suppression of dissent. Last October, the Biden administration signed an agreement to relax restrictions in exchange for President Maduro opening up the electoral process. However, suppression has continued, with the main political opponents being barred from standing in July's elections. Caracas has insisted its oil sector will keep going regardless of US policy. Rob Young asked Venezuelan journalist Victor Hamaya in Caracas whether Washington's decision to renew the sanctions was a surprise.
It was no secret that the sanctions will be reimposed. People are also noting that the license that it's keeping Chevron operating inside the country, it hasn't been touched. And that's the very important one, because the oil in Venezuela is being pumped mainly by Chevron.
So the big American oil giant Chevron will be allowed to carry on working in the country then?
What is the
potential economic impact of these sanctions?
The main income source of the Venezuelan government and in the Venezuelan state is the oil business. It's our only product of exportation at this point.
The Venezuelan economy has had a terrible decade or so. What is daily life like for most people at the moment?
2024 has been complicated. We all feel that the economy has lost the impulse that we saw in 2023. There is a lot of poverty still, and there is not much access to buying some food, some buying groceries, and buying basic things for living in Venezuela. There is no problems about the availability of goods, but the problem is how can you pay? And also the public services like water, electricity, cooking gas in houses, those are supposedly guaranteed by the government, but the system is broken. So a lot of people, even in rural communities and in poor communities, has to pay private company to get access to clean water, to keep businesses open, and to keep some sectors fully operating. It's also an expense that is really heavy in the people's budget month to month.
Now, the U.S. is reimposing these sanctions because President Nicolas Maduro broke various promises to do with the upcoming election. The candidate chosen by the opposition, who we had on the program a few weeks ago, was banned from running. So was the government expecting these sanctions to be imposed?
Yes, but also the president of the state oil company said yesterday that they were not only prepared, because they were also looking at the new license that the U.S. government issues, the license 44A, that permits the companies that were making businesses with PDVSA to keep doing businesses.
That's the state oil company.
Yeah, up until May 31 to finish those businesses, but also permitting the specific companies to ask Treasury Department permissions to continue operating in Venezuela. Every scenario presented by the opinion polls and the academia tells that there is no scenario in which, with a free and fair elections, Maduro will not be the losing candidate. So I think the threat of sanctions is never more dangerous than the threat of losing power.
Venezuelan journalist Victor Jamea speaking to Rob Young. Now, for many people, using a mouse or a keyboard to play video games or operate their computer is second nature. But for some disabled people, this can be much more of a challenge. The BBC's Paul Carter has been finding out about new software using movement as a controller.
Right, there we go, Sophia.
I'm at the Richard Cloudsley School in London. Although this is no ordinary lesson. Not only are these pupils getting to play video games during school time, they're also helping to test some exciting new software, known as Motion Input. Motion Input allows anyone to control their computers using any part of their body they can move.
If you open your mouth,
this could be by moving the eyes, individual limbs or body parts, or even by gestures, facial movements or speech, giving a raft of potential new input methods to disabled people. The collection of programs have been developed over 4 years by more than 200 students at University College London. Crucially, Motion Input doesn't need any additional specialised equipment. It works using a normal computer and webcam.
It's focused on AI for your PC, so it runs completely on your own laptops and PCs.
Dean Muhammad Ali is Professor of Computer Science at UCL.
Our work with the Motion Input software was developed in partnership with Intel. It has its own engine internal to do the evaluation of how people can be seen to be moving, and it uses just a webcam. Previous technologies that have been released have enabled children to play games with movements. This technology democratizes that. It makes it equitable computing, and from the perspective of a user choosing their own games, setting the movements that they want to set, and being able to play the way that they want to play it, that's where we think the real foundational challenge is.
Okay, let's do that.
The UCL students have been working with the pupils to help identify potential bugs or development issues with the software.
Are you ready, Safia?
Safia is using her eye movements to play different games that would ordinarily use a mouse or controller.
You're a better driver than I am.
Afterwards, I asked her what she thought, using her communication device.
It is good. It helps me to focus.
And is it easy to use?
Yes, it is easy. It helps me experience every action of the game.
And is it better than playing other ways you might have done before?
Yes. I've only tried the Nintendo Wii. This new controller helps me play better.
Over at UCL, the students working on different elements of motion input were keen for someone slightly less youthful to have a go and see how it works. First up, everyone's favourite block builder and basher, Minecraft.
So I'm just moving around here in Minecraft by using my right arm as a mouse and my left arm is kind of like a joystick. Oh, it's so cool.
I was also able to play Minecraft using eye tracking.
To look around. The cow! Ah!
You can attack the cows.
Oh, I don't want to attack the cows.
As well as Minecraft, I was able to take Rocket League for a spin, a game where you play football with cars, and try other games using different inputs such as head movements. A team is also developing software that will run using a phone camera.
You can go faster if you look at it.
Although the initial focus has been on gaming, the future aim is to commercialise the non-accessibility applications of the software into industries and spaces where touchless computing could be a benefit, such as manufacturing or healthcare.
Paul Carter with that report. Now, when it comes to American football, winning teams get trophies and the winning players get jewellery. And to that effect, a Super Bowl ring is one of the most coveted and expensive prizes in sports. Just imagine losing yours in a giant tank of chilli. Yes, chilli. Ella Bicknell takes up the story.
I legitimately lost my Super Bowl ring in this event. We have yet to find it. All of this stuff has been thrown away, so I think we can safely assume that my Super Bowl ring is now in a landfill someplace in the Cincinnati tri-state area.
That's retired NFL star Jason Kelce revealing he lost his Super Bowl ring in one of the strangest ways you could possibly imagine.
The Super Bowl ring is officially gone. We've already put the insurance claim in, which I think the insurance company might have some things to say about whether they're going to cover that.
100% they're going to have, especially if you're going to tell the entire world how you lost it.
Underdogs no more. The Philadelphia Eagles are the Super Bowl champions.
He's one of the most celebrated American football players of all time. In his 13 years playing all-pro football, he helped his team, the Philadelphia Eagles, make it to two Super Bowl finals, winning in 2018.
Welcome back to New Heights.
He co-hosts New Heights, one of the most successful sports podcasts, alongside his brother Travis, three-time Super Bowl winner himself and boyfriend of Taylor Swift. It was last week during a live show in their home city of Cincinnati, Jason lost his ring. The brothers hosted one game which had contestants wading into pools filled with chili, spaghetti and cheese to find Jason's ring amid several decoys. Except it was never found.
But there's actually metal in Skyline Chili. There's traces of iron within the chili itself. So it's an impossible task to try and use a metal detector. Somebody at some point messed with my Super Bowl ring, which I'm fine with. I mean, it's just a hunk of metal. I'll just have another one made, I think. They can do that, right?
Super Bowl rings are among the most valuable pieces of sports memorabilia. Intricately designed, packed with hundreds of gemstones, they can cost up to $40,000 to make, and some have sold at auction for more than $250,000. Unfortunately for Jason Kelce, there'll be no chance he'll win another one on the football field after announcing his retirement from the sport earlier this year. He's taken to X to say he was incredibly stupid in not taking greater care of it.
That report from Ella Bicknell. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Chesney Fawkes Porter, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Qureshi. Until next time, goodbye.
Kun lapsi syntyy, syntyy myös vanhempi. Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka, kolmen lapsen äiti, ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.